Good evening. I just have to make a note here. Okay, James McCanny with my Science Hour, going right into the show tonight. And the last few weeks I've been doing this from somewhat of a remote situation, so I hope the sound is at least audibly good. Also, I'm starting a lecture series tonight. I call it Kids to PhDs series. And so the idea is that everybody from kids to PhDs can learn from this. Tonight I'll be talking, the main science topic tonight, I'll be talking about coral in odd places. Coral is that rocky substance left by small sea creatures, and it builds up, they build up a big mountainous type of ridge that typically surrounds islands. So coral reefs are made in the ocean in shallow water. That's the only place they are made, and also in the tropics. There are warm water a group of creatures, and they go back to the earliest times on our Earth. So they have somewhat of a timepiece recording of our Earth, and when you find an old ancient coral reef, that tells you something about what was going on in that place of the Earth at that time. I'm also going to be talking about Comet Hartley. NASA had their deep impact spacecraft flying by the Comet Hartley today, and it sent back some pictures, which, of course, NASA interprets as a dirty snowball. So I'll be talking about that. You can see those pictures online, and you can see very clearly there's really nothing coming off the comet nucleus that would make a tail. And right in their article, I think it's rather comical, they try and state, well, it's too far from the sun for this nucleus to be putting out material for a tail, and so therefore you can't really see the material coming off the nucleus. But when you look at the distant pictures of the comet, it's definitely forming a tail. So how can a comet nucleus that is not putting out vapor, water vapor, in a nice even pattern form a nice even pattern tail? Well, of course, the answer is it can't. And so it's just this ongoing garbage science put out by NASA that is handed off to the public. Okay, so anyway, I'll be talking about the Hartley flyby. First of all, a quick announcement. Next week, Thursday evening, WWCR is switching to 5.070 frequency for this hour. So next week, right now you're listening at the 9.350 frequency. Next week, Thursday the 11th, November 11th, the show will be heard on frequency 5.070, so make a note of that. And thereafter, it will be on 5.070. And that's due to FCC changes, regulations that have gone on for... I went off of that frequency last spring, and WWCR made some efforts to get that frequency back. So now we'll be back to that. And also, so that's next Thursday. Remember, 5.070 is the megahertz, is the frequency, starting next week, November 11th, for this show. Also, just a note, remember, you can also hear this show on a frequency 5.755, 10 p.m., Friday night, and 3 a.m. Saturday morning. Those are all central time. And since this Sunday we're changing to daylight saving time, those times stay the same. But just remember that set your clock back and then you'll be on time for those shows. So once again, that's 10 p.m. Friday night, 3 a.m. Saturday morning. You can listen to this same show on 5.755 megahertz. Okay, I wanted to open tonight's dialogue with a story about a man that I met in Mexico back in 1971. In fact, I met the whole town, but this was just an interesting little story. We had been invited out to a archaeological dig. There was a huge new city that was being unearthed at that time, down the mountainside from Mexico City near Cuernavaca. And so we went out there and put our hammocks up and stayed for many, many days as the ruins were dug up out of the ground for the first time in thousands of years. It was an old Aztec ruin, and pyramids and masks, big rock masks, etc. It was just amazing to watch. And they had hired all of the residents of this little town, all of the men, to go out and work on the project of digging up the ruins. And it was being guided by an archaeologist. And so at any rate, the story goes like this. We were out there, and every day one man came out from the city, the little town I mean, and he did nothing but lay in his hammock, and he sang a song. And all day long he repeated this song. He said, I will never see Papantla, I will never see, and he listed off, I will never see, and he went through the whole litany of little towns in central and northern Mexico. I will never see Oaxaca, I will never see Guadalajara, and he just went through the whole litany of, and just went on and on with this song, and laying in his hammock. So finally, after a couple of days of this, we asked one of the women there that came out to make food for the men, said, what's this guy's story? What's his modus operandi here? So anyway, she said, well, he's dying. I thought, oh my goodness, the man is dying. And so clearly the song reflected that, in that he would never see any of these towns again. And he was a dying man and would never see any of these towns which he loved and visited as a younger person. And so then we said, well, what happened to him? And so the lady explained he had been bitten by a spider that had a venomous bite to it, insect venom, and it was poisonous, and he was dying. And so then, of course, the next logical question was, well, how long has this been going on? When did this happen? And the lady looks at us very matter-of-factly and goes, 10 years ago. And so, of course, the reaction is, well, wait a minute. This guy's been laying in his hammock, not working for 10 years, singing the same song, and everybody waits on him hand and foot because he's dying. But to them, it didn't have any significance. Time really didn't have any meaning to them. It was just he was dying, and yeah, one day he would die. So anyway, I just want to liken that to the NASA ongoing litany of dirty snowball as the NASA Deep Impact spacecraft flies by another comet nucleus and looking at it close range, taking pictures, and we see clearly that this is just another big dry rock. There's no hint of water on the nucleus. There are some jetting materials coming off of it, which clearly appear to be, it's hard to say because all you get is the NASA interpretation, but there are some ray-type materials. That's material that could be coming in as well as going out, because it just all of a sudden seems to terminate out in outer space. But at any rate, the point is that through the years, through the decades, and through the past 60 years, NASA has been relying on this concept of a dirty snowball being a comet. So anyway, that's why I wanted to start with the story of the man dying in the hammock in Mexico. And everybody looked at him like, yeah, he's dying. You know, he was bitten by a spider, he's dying, and he's going to die. But when you realize this was 10 years ago, you soon realize how ridiculous it is by any normal standard. But to those people, yeah, he's been dying for 10 years, and he's going to die from that spider bite. Well, clearly, he's long since passed the point at which he would die due to that spider bite. But it just shows you how illogical the human mind can be when it's put in its own environment, which is an environment in southern Mexico where time is not an issue. But also, if you're a scientist paid by government funding, time is not an issue. You can repeat the same thing for decades and get paid. So why not do it? If you make a wave and change your story, then you might not get paid. So the alternative is very real. Just wanted to mention also, I'm really not feeling very good tonight. So if my voice is a little weak, I apologize. But yeah, last night, I don't know if it's something I ate or if I got a touch of the flu, whatever. But I'm pretty weak tonight. So I'll just try and keep going here. Also, I want to talk about leaves. This is the fall. This is the time when leaves fall from the trees, especially in the northern climates. And by now, at least in the northern states like Minnesota, Wisconsin, the Dakotas, or Michigan, you know, out to New York, all the leaves have fallen from the trees. Now, of course, they blow all around. You can rake all you want, but the next day it seems like your yard is full of leaves again. But there's something you'll notice. As the wind blows, and as the wind blows the leaves, as the leaves blow the, as the wind blows the leaves around, something kind of strange happens. They seem to collect in certain areas. It might be an area out in the open. It might be behind a tree or a rock. But the leaves tend to collect in certain areas. And if you really examine it, what you're going to find is these collection areas are due to the way the wind blows. In these collection areas, the wind really doesn't blow. It might come around the corner of your house. It might come around the a tree. It might be behind a rock, something like that. But the point is that the leaves tend to collect in a certain point. Now, also, I want to mention that if you look at the water flow in a river, you see that behind rocks, as the water flows, there's a zone, kind of a quiet zone that builds up between behind the rocks. So the water is flowing, and it goes around the rock. But there's kind of a quiet zone where fish and sediment accumulate behind rocks. And that's just kind of a quiet zone. So at any rate, I want to point this out because comets do the very same thing. Comets will, as the electron beam from the sun comes in, hits the comet nucleus, there are areas around behind the backside of the comet nucleus where electrons accumulate, and this is the cause of charging. Also, there's a pressure that builds up on the sunward side as the electrons come in and slow down. There's a pressure that builds up. And all of this contributes to the negative electric charging in the vicinity of the comet nucleus. And since the electrons are much more in abundance in the current flow that passes through around the comet nucleus, then the negative charge of the comet nucleus is maintained. Then that draws in ions from the distance on the tail side, and that's what forms a comet. It's an electrical discharge of the solar capacitor with an object in the middle. So at any rate, when you talk about comets, you should look at the properties of comets and Tower 2, I'm getting some feedback and crossover talk from one of the other channels. Tower 2, I'm getting some feedback from one of the other towers. At any rate, okay, I'm going to keep going here. Hopefully you're not hearing this, the same thing I'm hearing in the headset here. Okay, so anyway, the point is that comets build up a negative charge around the nucleus. The tail material, which is ionized in the positive, positively ionized, then is attracted into this negative nuclear area, and that's what forms a comet. So you can predict all of the properties of comets based on this simple model. So I call it the plasma discharge comet model. It's a model I developed long ago in the 1970s as I studied comets back then, and I said there's no way comets could possibly be these dirty snowballs talked about by NASA and the other standard explanations. So at any rate, now we are at the fifth comet. There's been Comet Halley, comet Jacobini-Zinner, although they didn't really take pictures of that comet. They just had a flyby of a spacecraft with measurements, but no cameras. So Comet Halley, Comet Build 2, Comet Temple 1, and Comet Borrelly. Now this is the fifth comet, Comet Hartley, to have a flyby from NASA. None of them exhibited the snowball characteristics of a nice, evenly distributed amount of snow on the nucleus. That you don't find. None of these comets exhibit those properties. Typically they are hot, dry rocks. That's what you see. So it's like the man laying in the hammock who thinks he's been dying for 10 years. It's just about as ridiculous as that when NASA continues to talk about the dirty snowball comet model. In the explanation I saw online, so you can look up and see these pictures too. They're very nice pictures, close-up pictures. The nucleus of Comet Hartley looks like a drumstick, like a chicken drumstick that you would eat. It has kind of a ball at one end and a bigger ball at the other end and kind of a leg-looking portion in between. So it looks like a kind of a cosmic chicken drumstick. But be that as it may, with a couple extensions coming out, apparently it rotates very slowly. But in the descriptive article provided by NASA, they say this is a confirmation of the dirty snowball comet model. They reiterate that the belief that the solar system formed 4.5 billion years ago, and that comets could have brought water to Earth. Well, comets brought water to Earth, but we have historical records of them doing that much more recently, not 4.5 billion years ago, but certainly within the last 10,000 years, the Great Flood. So anyway, this does lead in nicely to the talk about coral and the discovery of coral in many places around the world. At any rate, do go online. Also, I'm going to reiterate that a couple weeks ago we had severe storms blowing through the northern states, actually all of the states, from Texas up to Canada, to southern Canada. We had a series of extreme storms, hurricane-force winds, and these things don't just happen. I always love the meteorological explanation that, oh, these just happen. It's just the month of November, so now we can have extreme storms. It's just ridiculous. No, things happen for a reason. There are scientific reasons. There are scientific explanations for the sources of these energies that we see in our weather system. And it's very explainable, not with the black magic explanation of, oh, it's now November and we can have storms now. So at any rate, here's what happened. I described this before, I think last week. But basically, here's what happened. Comet Hartley has an orbit. It came around behind Earth, a little bit further from the Sun than Earth, and we connected electrically to Comet Hartley. Earth already has its own electrical signature in space. And so these two hooked together. Now we have Jupiter out in the far reaches of the solar system. We connected with that electrically, and Uranus, another one of the big planets, very far out in the solar system, and we connected electrically with that. This is all in the earlier days of October. Well, in around the 24th of October, Venus comes around on the inside of Earth, creates another electrical connection, and here we have a solar system electrical connection all the way from the inside of Venus all the way out to the planet Uranus, with Jupiter in there, very active electrically, with Comet Hartley passing by, but it left its mark. It caused that extensive discharge of Earth, and so all of these things combined to give us that record wind, violent weather that occurred during the latter part of October. So as I'm saying, these are all explainable, but our standard meteorology does not use any of this, and the best they can do is, as I said, it's just, well, now is the month of November, and so we can have storms. But you can see that we have storms every month of the year. There's no month of the year that in which we don't have storms, sometimes up to hurricane force storms. So these all happen not because we happen to be in a magical month of November, but because we have physical conditions, electrical conditions that drive these storms. And of course, if you ask the question, well, what are they so afraid of? The very next question, of course, in your coming off your lips would be, well, if there's all of this electrical energy out there, why don't we tap into it and grab a hold of it and use it for our benefit, getting a good deal of almost free power. I don't call anything free because there's maintenance, there's equipment that is necessary. That's the next question that would roll off of anybody's lips from third grade up to the level of PhD. Well, I'd say there's probably more third graders that would ask than PhDs, because PhDs get their check and they don't want to rock the boats. At any rate, okay, on to the topic of coral reefs. Now, here's the situation. As I described earlier, coral is a rock formation made by little sea creatures. And they take the calcium in the water and they form calcium chloride and other hard, rocky materials in a form of a shell, and they live in there, and as plankton and other sea creatures come by, they tend to grab out and feed off of that. So they use the reef they build around them, a little stone house, so to speak, for protection. And of course, when they die off, that little house stays there, and their offspring builds their own little house on top of that. And so these build up over the long periods of time. And so by examining a reef, you can tell how long it has been there by looking at the structure of the reef. You can also date the reef. You can tell about what epoch in the world's history that reef was built. But something very interesting happens. As you go around the world and you look in high places and in low places, you find coral reefs in places where they never could have possibly developed. Let's take an example here. Here's a recent one that was announced. A group called Global Adventures found a large mountain chain landmass that was developed, they believe, 40 to 50 million years ago. And the scientists that studied this were from Greifswald in Germany. The mountain range is between 2,600 and 3,200 feet deep in the Caribbean Ocean, and initially they found a group of seamounts, in other words, mountainous regions in the Caribbean that had never been identified before. So in an area where the maps showed a flat region of the ocean, they, after closer study, found that the reefs, the mountain reefs, existed there, and they probably developed 40 to 50 million years ago. Fossilized coral, it's called the Hess Escarpment in the Central Caribbean. 620 miles long, a linear underwater cliff, it says, corresponds to a older fault line in the Sea of the Caribbean Sea. Okay, so now the researchers have a problem. How did the coral reef, which was developed around the ocean floor, right below the surface of the ocean, how did this all of a sudden become 2,600 to 3,200 feet below the ocean level? And, excuse me. Now, typically what happens at this point is the scientists try and imagine slow, meticulous changes that would lead up to this situation. But here's where the scientists' brains turn off. And once again, all of these scientists are trained that they can't talk about anything catastrophic. In other words, like a comet coming in, causing a big tidal wave in the Earth's surface and in the oceans, and causing surfaces to rise, surfaces to fall. I'll give examples also of coral reefs that are high in the mountains, up in the Andes Mountains, up in the Rocky Mountains, far away from the tropical regions. These coral reefs developed somewhere else relative to the North Pole and the South Pole. They developed in equatorial regions, and now they're high in the mountains or deep below the ocean level in some other place. So how did this happen? So, of course, the first thing these scientists do is they talk about plate tectonics. When this one, I read an article a little earlier today where one of the coral reefs was high in the Rocky Mountains, and they said it looks very much like the same kind of coral reef structure in the Andes Mountains. So the point is that the coral reef, they said, grew in the same area and then separated in over millions and millions of years. The part that's in the Rocky Mountains migrated to there, and the part that's in the Andes Mountains migrated down to there. Now, this is a pretty tall order, but there's basically a problem here. Imagine a coral reef forming. Okay, let's say it forms. It's formed. It's got the big rock structure. And then slowly it starts to move due to plate tectonics, which is kind of a cornerstone of modern science. And I'm just going to tell you right up front, plate tectonics does not work. It doesn't explain what we see. And this is one of the great examples, is the coral reefs found high in mountains far away from the tropical areas. So anyway, now imagine this coral reef. It's formed. It's in the tropical region. And now they say it starts to migrate. Okay, let's pretend that it can migrate. So it's moving along its merry way, northwards or southwards, and then also at the same time gaining elevation or dropping under the seafloor due to some other kind of geological activity. Here's the problem. That coral reef would soon become home to dirt, sediment, and other plants and animals that would be more that you would find in the more temperate regions of the earth, would start to use it as a home, as a base. So to find, and this would go on for millions of years as this alleged migration of this coral reef moved for tens of thousands of miles in some cases. So to find a pristine, unchanged coral reef high in the mountains, in the Rocky Mountains, high in the Andes Mountains, high in the Himalayas or wherever, or to find it under the ocean floor, simply doesn't make sense. Because as I said, it would slowly change, it would slowly be modified, and you wouldn't find this nice, pristine coral reef way out of a location where it formed. And so now let's say that it could happen once, but when you find these all over the world, and they're distributed all the way through Northern Europe, they're in the Southern Hemisphere, they're all over the place. They're in Thailand, they're all over the world. They're in the mountains next to Los Angeles and southern the Santa Monica Mountains. There's a big coral reef forest, so to speak, up in the Santa Monica Mountains outside of Los Angeles. So what I'm saying is that these very pristine coral embankments simply should not be there in the pristine condition that we find them. You might say one might make it through, but not all of them, all of them, all of them in this pristine condition. So that's the problem. But there again, you have scientists who simply cannot make that leap that something drastic happened on Earth, something radical happened to change the Earth. Now, I just want to mention that Velikovsky, in his books, talks about this situation. He talks about finding coral reefs and seashells high in the Andes Mountains. How does that happen? Well, now scientists are realizing that it's a problem, so they're coming out and trying to make amends, so to speak, but they do it by creating these absolutely fictitious scenarios using plate tectonics. So they have to use one lie to corroborate another lie, which corroborates another lie. And before you're done, every field, from evolutionary biology to plate tectonics, geology, to space science, all of the fields of science are corrupted. Now I want to read an article. Now this is very interesting. So there's two points here. First of all, coral reefs could not possibly migrate around the world as they do and show up in pristine conditions in faraway places. But the second part of this is the scientific community going along with the story that this is all just dandy, that there's no problem with this, and it's kind of this hand-waving science. I want to read a little bit from a coral. This is a recent discovery off of Thailand. Two mountainous islands off the coast of Thailand have been discovered, and they are up in the mountains above the sea level. They're replete with coral structures. They have stripes and patterns of coral reefs, and so these have existed, of course, for millions of years. It says there are numerous caves which have intricate limestone formations, and many rare wild plant species can be spotted in rock crevices. Now, this is the part I want to read, and I'll read this twice. The final sentence, it says, some experts would be asked to study the rocks to determine the mountainous origin before opening the site to the tourists. Now, look at what's going on. Before you go in and see it, before anybody with an alternative idea goes in to see this, the so-called experts will be allowed to go in there, create the standard explanation for how these coral deposits got up in these mountains off of Thailand, and then give the explanation that will be written down and translated and moved around to any place in the world that talks about these islands, and that will be the standard explanation. You see, they want to do this before anybody else gets in there to give an explanation or to analyze the situation. They got to keep their standard science corresponding to all of the other bad science that exists in the earth, in the Western seat of knowledge, so to speak. So at any rate, you find that when these are discovered, the coral reef deposits from around the world, when you find them discovered, the first thing you're going to find is a tier 2 scientist on the site giving you an explanation for how this coral reef deposit got to be where it is. So at any rate, I remember in reading Velikovsky's books a long, long time ago. This was after I developed my comet theories, and somebody said to me, this sounds like Velikovsky. I said, huh? Who's that? And he says, there's a guy that said comets did all this damage to Earth. So I started reading Velikovsky's books, and from a scientific perspective, verified with my own science work that this guy was right on. So it was very clear very early on that the problem was with the standard scientific community, and that's where the problem always has been, that they buy into this or support these concepts, which are totally incorrect. But they have the power. They have the power of the press. They have the power of government funding. And they monopolize the field of science. But then you find that this is very necessary, because if real science were allowed along with and introduced into this, it would be a house of cards. The concepts of scientific concepts that are in vogue today would all fall by the wayside overnight. Meteorology, geology, evolutionary biology, space science, all of these concepts would go under in a flash, in a heartbeat, because they simply don't make any sense. They don't add up, and they would all go down together. The second thing that would happen is that the people would start to ask questions, well, why is this? Why was so much effort put into putting out bad information? And the clear answer is, because if the public knew the real solution, the next question out of your mouth would be, why don't we use this source of energy for power? Get rid of oil, get rid of nuclear power, get rid of coal, and drive our needs with this free and available source of energy. Well, therein lies the problem. Because the people in charge use energy as a form of control. Just like money, banking, these are all forms of control, and their power would diminish and disintegrate overnight. So you now see how important it is for them to fund these fleets and fleets of Tier 2 scientists, while also funding in the background the Tier 1 science, which they get to see exclusively, and not the public, because only through ignorance can they maintain control. Only by destroying the true history of Earth can they maintain control. The real answer is that there are many big objects out in outer space. When they come into the solar system, they all will form a comet, and many of those comets throughout history, I wouldn't say many, but a percentage, probably actually a fairly low percentage, have come near Earth and the other planets and wreaked havoc on them. We see Mars as a planet, basically a water planet with all the markings of water, but without any water. Where did the water go? Well, one of the big comets came by and basically ripped off its atmosphere and oceans all in one fell swoop. Could that happen to Earth? Yes, and it's probably happened here before, where we lost all of our water, and it was brought back eventually, piece by piece, little by little, as Earth passed through the tails of other large comets throughout history. Did the atmosphere change? Yeah. The dinosaur atmosphere had to be very different than what we have today. Possibly there was a good deal of carbon dioxide. It's hard to imagine. But the Earth itself did not have much more glacier areas. Most of the Earth during the age of the dinosaurs for 65 million years, or what was it, actually about 180 million years, the dinosaurs died off 65 million years ago. But for most of the period of their existence, the dinosaurs lived on a tropical Earth from the North Pole to the South Pole. So how did that work? They must have had an extensive atmosphere. It must have been probably a good deal of carbon-related gases, and they probably breathed carbon. So they're a very different animal that could not exist in our climate of today. So in a sense, Jurassic Park, could it really happen? Probably not. Those animals would not live today in the environment we have. But anything is possible in a Hollywood movie. Yeah, that's an interesting point, that Jurassic Park would not exist if it could not exist in reality, just from the simple point of view that the atmosphere would be very, very different. So back to the concept of coral reefs around the world. Now, here's an assignment. I've called this lecture series Kids to PhDs. So kids can do this as well as PhDs. Go online to some of the Earth search engines, and typically I don't think Google is a very good one. I would not use Google myself. But at any rate, I would use your favorite search engine and search on the topic coral reefs in mountains, coral reefs in unusual places, coral reefs out of place, any series of words like that that would give you articles dealing with coral reefs that are not where they're supposed to be. And look at some of these, and it'll also bring up, like today I was searching, and I found some websites where they have a lot of pictures from outer space, and they show very unusual land features on Earth, showing all kinds of land features that don't make sense given the current environment. One was in it had a wash system, like a river system, a treed wash system, that was clearly formed by water, but it's in one of the driest places on Earth. So how on Earth did this wash system become involved, or how did it develop in one of the driest parts on Earth? So the only way you can explain that is to put a water environment there long ago, and then after time, the water went away and that part of the Earth became very dry. But this doesn't fit in the nice long-term scenario of planet Earth being the same for billions of years. And so the point is that in reality, the Earth has changed drastically many times, and probably with some serious mass extinctions involved. Sometimes serious mass extinction, and sometimes probably not much change at all. Just kind of a scare, high winds, that type of situation. Also, the nucleus of the comet can vary in size. So the point is that the nucleus, if it's small, is not going to come by and do much physical damage. There's no gravitational field significant enough to affect Earth. But if a fairly big one comes by, all of a sudden now you have a problem. You have something big enough to draw off our atmosphere and oceans in a single night of passage. No one would live through that. So we don't really know. Of course, NASA doesn't say if they know about such objects, and they are under a gag order not to say. I always get a kick out of the scientists and astronomers that are apologists for NASA. They go online and say, oh, we would tell everybody, if there was a problem, we would tell everybody immediately. I don't see that. I don't see it happening. And in fact, they're very definitely under a gag order not to do that, not to release information to the public. So at any rate, what I want you to do for an assignment, both kids and PhDs and everybody in between, is to go to the web or go to a library, but the web, of course, gives you a little quicker search results, and look up coral mountains, coral found in mountains, and just read about them. And what you'll typically see is an explanation of how amazing this is. And right away, following it, you'll see the standard explanation that this happened because of plate tectonics. These things moved over millions or hundreds of millions of years. But what's funny is if you start mapping these, then some coral reefs are moving in the opposite direction as other coral reefs at relatively the same time in history. So you start to see very soon that the real story breaks down. The real situation, when you try and apply these explanations, it breaks down. It doesn't explain them at all. It doesn't explain how coral reefs get high in the mountains. It simply does not explain it. So at any rate, I'll come back to this topic at the end. By the way, if you wanted to look at a couple of these articles, the web pages I got these from, global-adventures.us, that's the one talking about fossilized coral in mountains, 3,000 feet below the surface of the ocean. Once again, www.global-adventures.us. And the other web page that talks about the coral reefs in the mountains near Thailand is called divingathletics.com, divingathletic.com. No dashes, or it's all one string, divingathletic.com. And you would find the article dealing with coral mountains discovered off Thailand. Another thing you could search on and get to that webpage. But as I said, two things. First of all, you find these coral constructs all over the world. They are found every place around the world. And they don't belong there. They're at high elevations. They're at low elevations below sea level. But inevitably, the explanation comes back that somehow the Earth just did this by itself. with all of these coral reefs floating around, it just doesn't make any sense. But that doesn't matter because these people have PhDs, they have degrees, they can publish, they get grants, and they're in the inside loop. And so that's the problem, that most people are fooled by the idea that these people are credentialed. They have credentials, and therefore you should believe them. Anyway, I'm going to go on to just a quick discussion. I spent the last few weeks talking a lot about the freeze-dried food, and I'm not going to really talk about that tonight, other than I did put a posting up on the webpage describing how the cost is very commensurate with the cost of, say, for meat or vegetables in the grocery store. If you go to the grocery store and buy meat, and then you remove all the water out of it, like by a freeze-drying process, then the cost per pound is about the same as what you would buy freeze-dried. The only difference is you can save the freeze-dried food for up to 30 years, and you can eat it. It's good for you. It comes out of the can fresh. So that's it. Go to the webpage and check that out, jmccsci.com. That's all I'm going to say about that. With the, I'm doing better than what I thought tonight. I'm not feeling very well, so managing to move through this show. There are all types of geological features on Earth that don't make any sense. Mountain structures, the real analysis of plate tectonics doesn't add up. It doesn't explain what we see on Earth. It doesn't explain this, what appears to be very fast radical change in mountain chains. And so I know I've talked about this before, but I'm going to talk about very quickly. When a large comet nucleus comes by Earth, one that's, let's say the size of kind of a mini Jupiter, but very big, very massive, comes near Earth, it sets up a tidal wave in the ocean, but it also sets up a tidal wave in the land. Now, the land is more of a solid piece of material, and not literally solid in that you could cut it out and lift it up like a plate, but it's a lot less fluid, let's put it that way, than ocean water. So the wave is not as high, but let's say we have a 3 or 4 foot land wave rolling through the land. As long as there are no obstructions in the way of that wave, it will keep going. But once it hits something like a mountain, pre-existing mountain range, or a let's say also a very massive rock system that's in the ground, that wave is going to stop. It's going to stop there and unload its energy. That energy is going to turn into movement of the land up, and that's what causes mountain ranges. It's also what causes mountain ranges to drop down. This is all dependent on the structure of the Earth, the angle of attack of the existing of the inbound object. And remember, these are not direct collisions. These are action at a distance. These are gravitational waves that transmit through outer space and happen over a fairly large distance between the incoming object and Earth. So very rarely would we actually have a direct hit from something. The probability is fairly small, although I'm sure it's happened in the past. And you can see this all through the solar system. You can see that the effects of these objects coming through and passing by other objects in the solar system is very common, with also the objects passing through the tail material of the comet. So you find oil, water, other materials that are deposited. Then, for example, some of the moons of Saturn have very clear deposits of oil on them, and they have the characteristic spectral characteristics of oil, hydrocarbons, long-chain hydrocarbons in the form of crude oil, what we call crude oil and tars. So how does that happen? Well, they form in the tail, the electrical tail of the comet. So when the Earth finally passes through one of these tails, we pick up that material. That's a very standard process, also bringing in tremendous amounts of water into the Earth. So all of these factors contribute to the history of the Earth. And not all of this happened 4.5 billion years ago. It happened recently. We live in a dynamic solar system. It's not dead and lifeless with lifeless planets moving around for billions of years with nothing happening. That's simply not the way it works. So, at any rate, the oceans themselves, the contours of the ocean basins, the contours of the mountains, the contours of the plate systems that surround Earth, all of these are the results of repeated and many encounters with comet nuclei as they come through the solar system. And then also at the same time, volcanoes are going off. Earth is basically under attack. But in this change, in this violent change, comes new changes, new life, new types of life forms. That's where evolution takes that evolutionary jump to the new. And without that change, evolution itself would not work. It would take far too long for evolution to work. So that's something that standard science has discovered and actually borrowed from Velikovsky, who brought that idea to light, that the evolution itself would not work if it were not for these violent activities that occur in the solar system. So just in summary, modern scientists discover, and rediscover, I should say, fossil ruins in faraway places, places where they could not have possibly developed. They are all over the world. They are from different epochs of comet passages. The large comets did this, not little teeny comets like Comet Halley or Comet Hartley. These were the big comets, the ones that came ripping through the solar system doing extensive damage. And there are many, many of these. This has happened many times in Earth's history. And it's going to happen many times again, and probably when we're here as a population. And they're random in time. There's no way to predict when these things are going to happen unless you are NASA with the good equipment and can see these objects and tell when they're going to come into the solar system. But as I've said before, they're not going to tell you. They're under a gag order, and they're not going to tell you, the public. So out there someplace, sometime, something very likely could be coming in to the inner solar system. I don't have any information at this time, but as far as the population, people have to learn to take care of themselves. People have to learn to prepare, and the Old Testament talks about this. It's very clear that a man should prepare for his family and become prepared so that in case of eventuality, if something happens, he's prepared to take care of them. I really think this. I think more and more there's going to be a day when people simply don't have money to go to the grocery store. They're not going to have money to go buy gasoline. They're not going to have money to travel. For the first time in history, I've seen airline prices dropping like a rock. Say just a flight to Denver would take $350 from Minneapolis. That's just an example. You can get tickets now for $150. What's going on? What's the deal? It's a real, the economy just isn't there. I hear people talking about the economy. Excuse me. A little bit of a sneeze there at the end of the show. But I'm surprised I've gotten this far with the show. So I'm winding down to the end here. As I said, this is the first in the Kids to PhD series. This will be running up through Christmas time. And also, I just wanted to mention, I'll have a little bit more of information on this. I talked to a worker out there in the field named John Rappaport. I'm sure many of you have heard that name on Coast to Coast and other radio talk shows where he talks about the situation with many situations, disinformation coming out of the, for example, the medical industry. But I'm going to be on a show with him. It's going to be 6 p.m. on November 24th. In other words, it's his show. I'll be the guest. So just pre-announcing that, I'll have some more information on that as time goes on. And I wanted to present this information on Comet Hartley on some of the major radio shows that I typically am on, but with no invitation coming back. So I'm not sure what's going on there. But anyway, so I had to cover it on this show. Anyway, I'm about out of time here, so I'm going to sign off. Remember, kids and PhDs, to go out and search on the internet for coral in unusual places, in the mountains, under the sea, and study that. It's a very interesting topic, and you'll see that these are pristine structures. They existed long ago, and they didn't change. Something moved them very rapidly to where they are today. That's it. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.